know, just test the levels. If you hold this like a sort of stand-up microphone.
Do you want to pin it on, is it?
Like, no, we hold it like sort of like that.
Do this. This is amusing but fun.
Fantastic.
I feel like I'm on the Muppets speaking into a fairy ball. Here we go.
We've had it described as such in the past.
Great.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. We're back from hiatus whilst I was at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival directing a few shows, including Alex Franklin Girl Code and Vlad Illich Vladislav Baby Don't Hurt Me. So it's fitting that these next two episodes of the podcast are all about directing, and specifically two directors whose work has not just inspired me, but has genuinely changed my life. It's also fitting that this first episode involves some time travelling, as, and try and get your head around this, we recorded the following conversation at the National Theatre a couple of hours before recording the previous episode with Francesca Moody. And it's fitting that it involves time travel, as my guest today has directed in back-to-back productions the last two Doctors, David Tennant in Macbeth at the Donmar Warehouse, and imminently Shuti Gatwa in The Importance of Being Earnest at the National Theatre. We talk about the constructions of both of these, as well as his training at Lecoq, making the invisible visible, directing barefoot, how TV and film perfecting hyperrealism has changed theatre, turning Life of Pi into a global stage sensation, and so much more. So let's get straight into it. Recorded this summer at the National Theatre, please welcome my guest for this episode, the Tony and Olivier nominated director, Max Webster. Max, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start with going back to early 2022. And personally for me, I'm not moved to London yet, but I come up for a couple of days post-pandemic, and I see a show that I think is extraordinary, and I don't know how it's done, but I think it's amazing, and I want to be involved in that world. And that's Life of Pi at the Wyndham Theatre. We'll go into more depth of the show in a bit, but is there a show that you can remember exciting you about the possibility of theatre in such a way?
Yes, totally. And that would be a wonderful thing to say. Thank you. It's very kind. And I loved the phrase, I don't know how it's done, because I remember being a kid in London in the 90s and starting to go to theatre as a teenager. I was very lucky. My parents took me and my school took me a bit. And I saw lots of quite traditional plays at the National at that point, and in other places, Richmond Theatre, I think. Often good actors, but, you know, the well-made play with a box set, and those scene changes where everyone comes on in black and moves furniture around, hoping you don't notice it. What I think Stephen Daldry called burglary theatre. So I grew up seeing that. And then at the age of 16, I saw Street of Crocodiles that Complicité had made. And it blew me away, and one of the reasons it blew me away is I had literally no idea how they did it. So I think, although obviously I couldn't have made the well-made plays that were going on, you know, the new David Hare play or whatever, I had a sort of rough idea what happened, which is that a playwright wrote a play and then some good actors talked about it and tried it a few times and then did it on a set that looked quite like the place it was supposed to represent. And then in Street of Crocodiles, people walked down walls and popped up from places, and it looked hallucinogenically transformatory, and people could transform, and music could transform things, and a train could appear out of a flurry of books, and someone could be shot with two fingers, which they are in Hamilton, so, you know, proving there's no such thing as a new idea. But I guess what I loved about that was that I had no idea how it was done. And so I suppose one of my quests as a young theatre maker was try and work out how some of that work was made. So very clearly, not knowing how it's done for me is linked to that production of Street of Crocodiles.
It seems fitting that with your style of theatre, which for me seems to be an exploration of the philosophical and the psychoanalytical mixed with boundary-pushing technological, and it seems to be... Sondheim was described as like a puzzle maker. Do you view shows as a puzzle to be solved, or working out how to make that in the same way that you know, 15, 16, seeing those shows going, I don't know how they do that, but I want to work out how they do that. Do you start with a challenge?
I like starting with a challenge. I think it's good to start with a challenge. I think even, I mean, Life of Pi was very much a challenge, and there were very practical instant challenges, like how are you going to make a tiger, how are you going to put a boat on stage. I think even before you start with a challenge, you have to start with a feeling or a sense or a question or the idea that in this material somewhere is something worth all that technical effort. So obviously the puppets and the video in Life of Pi and the movement and the acting and lots of those things are really, really extraordinary. But all of that technical effort and human human inventiveness, which is very concrete and technical, and like making puppets and working out how they work and queuing up music and lining that up with the video, all of that, which is the bulk of the job, has to be at service of something meaningful. It has to be in service of an emotion or a sense or an idea that you feel is worth communicating. Otherwise, it's just sort of virtuosity for its own sake.
Yeah.
And actually, what you hope is when it really works is that all the elements, the acting, or whether there's technical language, whether there's technical elements on top of that, all of that's adding up towards something that's got a human force to it. And I think I say human force because I think it's, I'm looking for that moment when a human story, a personal story, meets a political story. Mm. So there's something in the story of a boy going from South India to North America on a boat that is both emotionally resonant, because what is that about survival? But that emotion broadens out into political resonances, because why do people move around the world? Why is it that people are needing to change continents? And what does that mean in our modern society? So the two things go hand in hand. And I think that is, in a way, that's not really a puzzle to solve. That is a sense that in this material is something worth excavating and trying to share with lots of people. And then the joyful problem puzzle solving stuff that comes later is part of how on earth do you do that.
Yeah. On that notion of excavation, you've spoken a lot about the idea of making the invisible visible. You said in an interview about Life of Pi that it was a personal story because it had religious themes which evoked your upbringing in the Christian church, although that's a more complex subject for you now than it was back then. But you link the religion and theatre in the sense of making the invisible visible. And this seems to connect with your work with Yoshi Oda.
Yes.
With
Yoshi Oda. Yes.
Yoshi Oda, my apologies.
That's right.
With the idea of pointing at the moon in no theatre. If you could expand on that and how they connect to your mind.
Well, that's a big subject. Maybe we should do a little detour on Yoshi Oida, sure. Who is an amazing actor who worked with Peter Brook for a long time, but before that trained both in No and Kabuki Theatre in Japan. And in his book, The Invisible Actor, he talks about learning the traditional No gesture for pointing at the moon. And he spent a long time studying it, and that actually every rhythm and movement and muscle is choreographed in that gesture. And then eventually the master said to him, you've got the gesture absolutely down, you're doing it right, but now you've got to actually see the moon. And that it's in that last bit that all the technicality and the years of training and this very rigorous and codified historical tradition ultimately are not worthless, but don't really come alive until you add the imaginative element and the invisible moon becomes visible because of the way, partly through technique of how the actor's finger moves and eyes move, but then ultimately that technique is surpassed by an act of imagination that makes the moon present. I suppose I have always been drawn to theatre that is less literal and more imaginative, and one way of doing that is saying that I saw Street of Crocodiles when I was 16 and went, sure, gosh, that's what theatre can do. Another way of doing that is saying that what you were talking about, so yes, I was Christian as a teenager for a bit, and it was a very helpful time for me, actually. I was in a very warm and inclusive church, and a lot of the values I learned in that church are values that I carry with me in my life and my work, even though I'm not a Christian anymore or practicing Christian. But I think the sense that some of the most important things that happen within people and between people are not immediately visible is given me an important sense of what theatre can do. And that sense of when everyone goes to church and comes together to try and evoke that invisible thing, which could be called God or could be called meaning, I suppose, is linked to what we all do when we gather in a theatre. We're all, I mean, partly we're looking to have a good night out because we've spent some money and got babysitters and travelled on the sweaty tube to go and do it. So sure. We want entertainment and we want to be taken out of ourselves. But I think, you know, if we just wanted that, we could go and do that elsewhere in a different way. So I think we're also looking for an understanding of something that we don't normally see, something that is invisible to us, made clear, and something kind of a present, something made present in a way that's powerful and moving, which obviously isn't the same as going to a religious service, but I think has its link in that as a kind of communal shared experience. And I guess that means if that's what you think theatre is doing, helping you see something that's invisible or understand something that you can't immediately see or not everyone sees because it's in the heart and mind of one person or because it's about how a society works, then that means that the form of theatre I'm most interested in is a less literal form of theatre and a more poetic form of theatre that suggests that you can ask the audience to imagine we're, say, on a boat or in 12th century Scotland, rather than having to literally illustrate, put literal water on stage or put historical mink furs on stage.
Sure. Yes, presumably that comes from your training at Le Coq, in terms of shapework and physicality.
Yeah. Jacques Le Coq was very interested in what the body could make the audience imagine. And I suppose his work was less about a psychological process, where it's about what the actor imagines and how they use their psychological past, but more about what the actor sees and imagines in the present moment and how that can be incorporated into their body through physical storytelling. And that he had a sense that anything can be told on stage with the body, and that you could do a journey around the world without any stuff. I remember one of the most amazing weeks was our weekly task was to make Voyage Around the World. And we had five humans, actors, and it all had to take place on a little platform that was 1 meter by 2 meters large. Okay. And so we were all squashed together. So it meant that we had to do Voyage Around the World with very few words, but tell a very clear story just with four bodies. And, you know, we travelled all over the place. We went under the sea, we went up to the sky, we had kings and queens and all that sort of stuff. And it was, on the good ones, it was very clear where we were, and it was just as clear with those four bodies. When it really worked, it was just as clear with those four bodies on that little platform than it was in a more traditional theatre where you'd need to bring the set to be at the castle and the set to be in the forest. And in a way, more pleasing, because the fully realised forest set doesn't actually ask you to engage your imagination to think what it is. Yeah. But when the three bodies are being the forest and one person's walking through them, then we know it's a game, we know it's playful, and it's almost like we're offering out a hand to the audience and saying, please come along and imagine this along with us. We know we're not trees, we're Max and Eloise and whoever else is there doing the work, and Anton, but actually we're asking you to imagine, to play along with us. And I think that sort of work is of greater interest to me because it somehow engages our imagination on the deepest level.
Yeah, and the playfulness and the creativity in it is inviting the audience to be as creative as those putting on the show.
I think so. And I also think that what's happened now is that as we can access so much film and television, and we all have these devices and our consumption of television and film is high. Sure. We can watch Netflix in the evening, we can watch YouTube on the train. That the space of hyperrealism has been taken very beautifully by film and TV, and that there are certain forms of storytelling that actually now are better done on camera, and that cameras are very, of course you can have surreal cinema, but that actually literal naturalism is often more realistic and effectively done on camera, and that actually what that's released theatre into is an ability for theatre to concentrate on the theatrical elements, not on the purely literal elements of representation. I suppose, just as in a way, if you look at the history of painting in the West in the 20th century, the way the advent of photography released so much painting from its literal task of capturing likenesses of people, places and things in real life into the gestural, the abstract, the expressionist, the non-literal modes of painting. Theatre, I think, has been slower to release its grip on literal naturalism in the advent of film, but that the things theatre can do, which are imaginative, playful, non-literal, involving the presence and body of the actor and the mind and the imagination of the audience, well, I think that's all there to be grasped right now, and what's what makes theatre most theatrical and most essential.
Yeah. Kip Williams, who's the director of Dorian Gray, the recent Sarah Snook one, talks about that theatre, for him, is intrinsically spatial. It's about how you use the space of that physical building that people are sitting in and watching the thing. Presumably you go along with that sense of thinking then, in terms of it's what theatre can provide that film and television cannot.
Well, in theatre, you are in a shared space with the performer.
Yeah.
And there are some types of theatre that try really hard to fight it. So the Stanislavskian idea of the fourth wall implies that actually what the actors are really doing is almost like acting behind a screen, as it were, and that therefore in the room they're not acknowledging in any way the presence of the audience, and they're trying to pretend the audience isn't there. Mm. And that is one tradition. I suppose there's another tradition that started at the Globe Theatre, or even before that, that didn't have a fourth wall, but the Globe doesn't even have a second or a third wall. It only just has a first wall at the back,
which
starts with a different sort of thing, which is not, this is an absolutely real slice of life from some other place through a screen, but rather, I'm a performer and you're an audience member. Here we go, let me reach out a hand to you and tell you a story.
Yeah.
And that's the tradition that I think Jack Lecocq came from and was interested in.
Yeah. We'll move on to the other plays in a moment, but on one final point on Lecocq and how it relates to it is, you did a masterclass recently for Theatre Royal Haymarket, which I was there for, and you talked about how there was an exercise you did in training where the teacher would get you to walk barefoot and they could see what types of shoes you would normally wear. I was wondering if you could expand on that in terms of what that then you can take as a theatre maker or as a director of actors based on how people move without shoes but still carry their shoes with them.
Yes, I suppose in some ways the Lecocq School is what they would call a school for the regard, a school for observation, a school for looking. And this was a class, I remember very clearly, it was Pascal Lecocq, Lecocq's daughter, teaching it. And we all walked around and she could point out who often wore high heels or not by the way the body moves.
Mm.
And I guess that's only the tip of the iceberg. And what she was asking us to start looking at is that all stories, in a way, can be contained within the human body, that the human body is capable of expressing all emotions, we know this, but also all situations and all places and all stories, and that a thing so subtle as how tense our ankles are tells us about shoes, which is a minor point, but actually, if you learn to look with that level of detail and clarity about every aspect of the body and how it moves, its tension, its rhythms, its intentions, how it uses space, how it reacts, how it gestures, all those sorts of things, you can actually accurately recreate and tell any story you like. So you could tell the story of how a prisoner's wrists are sore after handcuffs. You could tell the story of having the sore heels after you've come back from the Met ball. You can tell the story of the way you hold your chest because you're anxious. So all those little physical details add up to a complete way of fully embodied storytelling.
Mm. Moving on to Macbeth, the Donbar, I think the greatest encapsulation of Shakespeare that I've seen, and I've seen it twice. And
this is incredibly nice. I should go on more podcasts. This is great.
No, keep it as an exclusive. There's so much to dissect about that. But I'll start with in the Nick Hearn published script. Assistant director Alessandro Davison kept a rehearsal diary, and she includes the line, Max kicks off the afternoon of the first day by talking us through his rehearsal room ethos and the kind of environment he wants to create. What is a Max Webster rehearsal room ethos?
Well, I think in particular what Alexandra was referring to was talking about really particular codes of behaviour in the rehearsal room and what it means to treat people with respect, to try and create a space that's free from problematic and hurtful behaviour and so on. So that's a kind of, in a way, a contract that we all try and make at the beginning of a process to protect all of us, really, and work out if and when things go wrong, what are the processes in place to try and resolve those difficult situations. Beyond that, what is a Max Webster rehearsal room like? Well, I hope on a good day, it's hardworking and it's fun. So I think that's the two things we try and do, and that it's collaborative. So some directors know what they want before they start. So I always hear people say, what's your vision? And I get quite confused because I don't really have a vision. I feel more like I have a compass and I can sort of point where we're going a bit.
Yeah.
But then I don't know how we get there. And I'm not the climber. I'm not the rock climber. I'm not the person who then actually has to work out how to get up the cliff face. I'm like, I think it would be great if we went up here. And then we have to all kind of learn to climb together. So I suppose it's about trying to support the actors doing their work in working out how to tell the story and being detailed and demanding and kind and playful to create a space in a room in which they can do that work, but that we're all doing work in the same same way, in the same place. So we're all trying to make the same thing visible, if you like. We have a sense of what it is we're aiming for, and that we're creating a culture in which it's okay to try things and fail, so that it's always all right to go, well, what if I come in backwards and then say it like this, and you go, yeah, great. So try and have a room in which the default position is, yes, great, let's try it.
Yeah.
But equally, along with hoping that all the actors can have as much creative autonomy as possible, you have to try and find a way that you can also hold and shape the material. Mm. So it's always a question as a director of how hard and how tight you hold other people's creativity. Because if you hold it too tight and too rigidly, you're really the only creative voice in the room. And if you let it completely go and everyone has the same role in the room, then the material is very hard to shape and you don't have... And that's actually not a good condition for everyone to be imaginative in. So how do you retain the ability to say yes and no to people's ideas and shape them, but also let people feel really free to discover things for themselves? The great French director, Ariane Mnouchkine, said something that has always struck with me, that you can't defend something you haven't imagined for yourself. So that if you can lead actors to imagine it for themselves rather than giving them answers on a plate, then you will have more committed performances. And also, you have better ideas than if you just have ideas yourself, because it's a group process. I mean, occasionally that doesn't work, and at some point in the process you have to try and offer some solutions if that person isn't finding solutions that seem to work with the production you're trying to do. But that the sense of group exploration is very, very important.
Mm. You've essentially answered my follow-up question in that the previous guest on the show was Brian Cox, and I was asking him about the how much of a role is created by a director as opposed to an actor. And I suppose the answer then is it depends on the character. But taking David Tennant's interpretation of Macbeth as a specific example, how much did David bring and how much did you posit?
David's completely extraordinary. So David, in some ways, didn't really need a director. He was kind of ready to go very early in the process. And we had to kind of make and work out the world around him. And that was thrilling and kind of terrifying because he was there.
Sure.
Kind of brilliant on day one. I think, in a way, I make the frame and he then goes in the middle of it.
Sure.
I guess I came to David with quite a clear conceptual idea that we could look at Macbeth through a particular lens, the lens of trauma, of being a soldier experiencing trauma, and as a couple who's lost a child, and that in a way we could then set the play inside Macbeth and Lady Macbeth's head. And really brilliantly, David and Cush both said, okay, let's do it. And, you know, there are many pairs of leading actors that would be scared by that and have said, no, I want the more literal, traditional interpretation, but they were both incredibly supportive. So I suppose I set the direction of the production in terms of the rules of the staging and how the kind of the grammar of the stage worked.
Yeah.
But then in terms of how those roles developed, it's the actor's work. And, you know, like all of these things, they come out of... I think the other thing to say is these things come out of conversation. So... You never really know whose idea it is. So that when something's working really well, it's not that one person necessarily has the idea and then the other person does it. It's that in a fruitful conversation, good ideas are had by all.
Yeah.
And out of that conversation, we then try stuff. And so you don't really know how much is one person and how much is the other. What you hope is that it's a creative environment in which good things can happen.
Totally. And you seem to put a lot of emphasis on making it as rich an environment from which to draw from all the creatives. The experts you brought on very early on in the process, in particular Captain Tom Lee, to talk about his experience with PTSD. Presumably then that's a part of allowing the actors to inhabit the world and therefore make decisions that make sense for them, which then creates the helps co-create the play as a result of that.
Yes, absolutely. So we had an expert on, we had a former soldier who's a wonderful man who does a lot of theatre work now.
Okay.
And I think in a way it's to help the actor make it real.
Mm.
So that we all know that when you have a hallucination, you can hear someone talking in the next room. We've all read about that.
Yeah.
But when you actually, and some people of course have experienced that, but when you sit in the presence of someone really explaining what it's like to hallucinate things and talking you through that process, beat by beat and moment by moment, then that experience has a kind of reality to it, because it's not just something you see on telly or in a book, but something that you've actually heard someone talk about. And so I think it's easier as an actor and as a director too to commit to the truth of that. And believe that that's a thing that people actually do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can see a dagger. Well, this guy saw guns and things, so I'm seeing a dagger. And so there's a sort of, it doesn't have to become a leap of faith in quite the same way. It can be played as a more real thing.
Yeah.
And likewise, Kush and I were very interested in postnatal mental health of mothers and families, and that's something that we are both interested in and wanted to bring into the production as well. And so we did some research together. It's something Kush has been researching for one of her projects, and we did research together into what that's like to try and think about the ways in which the loss of a child has affected the Macbeths.
Yeah.
And again, it goes without saying, we all know intuitively that losing a child is awful, but that taking time to weirdly going, oh, that's awful, I know, means weirdly you sort of think you know about it. But actually sometimes it takes time to lift the lid on these things properly and really think about what it's like, what are the stages, what's the process, what does it result in, what does it mean? And all those things are, this sounds a bit callous, but in this production, they're material for an actor to grow stuff and mould stuff out of. And I suppose also they are ways of trying to be responsible about serious subject matter as well. So that if you do think that theatre is talking to points in which individuals are going to be very tender about, because that is some people's experience, then you want to get it right, or as right as possible. And of course, it's a fiction, so there is no such thing as right, but you don't want to fall into cliches, you don't want to fall into generalizations, you don't want to fall into stereotypes, you don't want to fall into things that people who have experienced these things tell you is categorically not how it works.
Yeah.
So there's also a kind of research to it. And I think belief in the truth of it as well. It helps make it feel real, which is, I think, a big part of what Kush and David and that whole company of actors did so brilliantly, is made it feel as real as possible as it could with this old play.
And it completely achieved that. It's an incredibly absorbing performance that everyone gives. And it does seem incredibly grounded for quite a minimalistic set design. There's not, as you said, there's not, I suppose there is a candle, but it's not candle lid, it's not sort of furs, it's not any of like that kind of stuff. It's very stripped back and very minimalistic, and the emotion does resonate as truthful and honest. And that's informed by one of the major aspects of the production, which is the technological side of it.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did the idea of Gareth Fry's binaural sound scaping come to you as an idea of let's put the voices of in their heads in the audience's heads?
Well, I had a meeting with David And I knew he was going to ask me, how are you going to do The Witches? Because that's, what any sensible actor would ask any director worth their salt. And I had absolutely no idea. And so I rang up one of my pals, who's been very helpful to me, who's an academic and dramaturg called Zoe Svenston, who's been doing a lot of research into theatre and climate at the moment, which is really interesting. And I'd recommend people looking up her work. It's really brilliant.
Sure.
And we were talking, it was out of a conversation. And, again, good ideas come out of conversation, so I can't promise you whether this was her idea or my idea, but it felt like it was a fruit of that conversation we had. We talked about not wanting to identify the witches, and that somehow the play could take place in the Macbeth's head. And it feels that, to me, that slightly links to how the other characters work, so that the other characters in Macbeth are, I think, slightly confusing. So in Hamlet, for example, we always know which one's Laertes and which one's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I've never got that muddled. Whereas even though I'd read Macbeth quite a few times and seen it a few times, I was always a bit muddled about the names, which one was Malcolm and which one was Macduff. And so there's a sense that, in a way, these characters transform and come out of a group and morph and change and kind of bleed into each other in a much weirder way than other Shakespeare's plays. And so I wondered, my first thought was even more radical, which was there a way of doing the play with Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, and a dead child? So you could do it as a three-person play, and then all the other voices would be binaural in a box. And so that you'd go, that's literally two people hearing voices, and the only thing that's left that's real is their child who's died. After we tried that for a little bit, and that actually felt a little bit extreme, and that it was going to end up asking Cush and David to spend the whole evening talking to air, and that that wasn't what I thought I wanted to ask them to try and do, and that it wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have been about the relationships that are actually so important to the play.
Almost like green screen acting at that point.
It could have been like green screen acting. And I think talking to the actors, there was something they felt it was a little bit more like being in a film than it was like being on stage. Because they don't know, when you act on film, you don't know how it's going to be edited or what's happening to it in post in some ways. So that in this version of Macbeth, they weirdly couldn't all hear themselves and they couldn't all hear the music.
Yeah.
And so they had to kind of trust that the kind of equivalent of post-production was happening live.
Yeah.
And some actors really liked that, and some actors found that more stressful. But, that's okay.
Sure.
The idea was, could you put the play in Lady Macbeth and Macbeth's head? And also, what do you do with the witches? So if you follow Shakespeare's directions, Shakespeare would have had three men playing the role in dresses, wearing hook noses with beards, pretending to be disabled, walking around a cauldron. And every aspect of that seemed like something something that we weren't about to do right now.
Sure.
However, it seemed to me that this is one of the greatest plays in the English language, and that it must be meaningful, so that the witches have now become that representation of witches is A, impossibly prejudiced for many ways, but also like a cliche that isn't interesting or meaningful, but that Shakespeare was aiming at something that meant something.
Yeah.
So I'd wondered about this idea that what is the cauldron? Well, the cauldron is this element into which you throw all these horrific things, like dead animals and parts of bodies, and out of it comes, at the very first scene, a bloody man is the first stage direction. So in a way, a cauldron is an instrument to produce an image of horror, which made me think, well, really, a cauldron then is a sort of theatre, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so instead of the cauldron being a literal brass pot on stage into which bits of animals are thrown and you have bubbling sounds, could you actually make the theatre into a cauldron? And by that means a kind of mechanism or a piece of technology for creating images of horror.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that was the idea, the two ideas that came into headphones. I guess there's another really practical thing I thought, which is that when you read Macbeth, the lines are extraordinary, and you go, oh my gosh, that's a really meaningful and interesting line, and that's really beautiful, or that's sad, and that's complicated.
Yeah.
And my experience of seeing the play live is that those lines tend to sort of be said and go on, and then we're sort of into the slightly boring fighty bits, and actually the bits that you think of are the reasons for doing the play sort of bob past so fast they don't quite land. Mm. And so I thought that the headphones might give the play a verbal intimacy and a psychological intimacy that I think the play might have originally had in Blackfriars and Candlelight, but that is quite hard to recapture now, and in a way of asking people to listen again to it, a thing we know so well. How do you go, hey, folks, actually, what you're going to do now is listen really hard. It's going to be like a listening thing to do, because that might be the way of giving the language its greatest impact.
Yeah, and it totally felt more incredibly intimate. What struck me was that it was, going back to your comment about it was sort of like film acting, it was sort of the reverse in that it was, it married the idea of when you watch a TV show or film, you have continuity of sound but not of shot. So you can go from a high angle on a cliff to a two shot or a close up, and the sound is still the same. You hear that conversation. You don't have that in real life, with the exception of this specific production, where no matter where they were in the geography of the Donmar, you heard the whispers and you heard the intimacy there, and it did make it both kind of comforting in terms of how close we were, but also off-putting, because this isn't what normally happens. If someone's 20 feet away, they sound 20 feet away instead of close up, even with microphones and technology in theatres. Am I right in thinking, in terms of how you got the sounds in the different ears? I remember seeing Monsters, Inc. Stay with me on this. I saw Monsters, Inc. about 20 years ago in the DVD features, and I remember watching John Goodman and Billy Crystal walk around a head, or a microphone in the shape of a head, and as they walk around the left ear, you heard it in the left ear and the right
ear. Absolutely.
Is this what, I want to call him Fritz, is that right? Is this what Fritz was, the microphone in this production?
So what you're describing is a binaural microphone,
okay,
which is actually a technology that's been around for a long time. So lots of people think that it's the headphones that are the cool bit of tech, but actually it's not the headphones. The headphones are just normal headphones. What's amazing is the microphone, and the microphone is a crude description of it is basically two microphones with a block of wood between it that resembles a human ear, the centre of a human head, and then ear-shaped holes on it. And so that microphone records sounds spatially, so that it records the angle and the distance to the ear, so that when you close your eyes and you hear a sound, you can, if you have two well-functioning ears, you can hear not only the content of the sound, but you can spatially locate it. And that's because we have two ears, and that's because we have binaural hearing. Mm. And so binaural microphones replicate that technology so that the sound is spatialized.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And that's what we were doing on the show.
Sure. And also on the subject of on the headphones, am I right in thinking there was perhaps it came from conversation of, was it Zoe you mentioned before, of the writing about climate activism in theatre or climate aspects of theatre? It was an eco-conscious show, and elements of the production came from other theatres and other productions.
Yes.
So the glass is from Phaedra?
That's right.
And the headphones, were they from Complicité?
They're from Complicité's production of The Encounter.
Where did that... How did you know they existed to use them, and how did that affect the creative process?
Well, theatre is currently quite a high-waste industry, in that our traditional model has been to build a new set of set and costumes for every show we do.
Yeah.
And that isn't how it used to be. So in Shakespeare's day, they had a prop store, and we know that the Hell's Mouth from Faustus came out again to do various other shows with Hell, and the trees that did As You Like It probably did The Tempest as well.
Or Burnham Wood.
Or may well be Burnham Wood, yes. In the Simon Foreman, who's the only person who wrote a same-day description of Macbeth when he went to see it, said at the beginning of the show the two guys were riding through a forest. So maybe Macbeth opened with a forest. It's possible.
Okay.
Because there's no description of the forest in the text.
Yeah.
So if he thought they were going through a forest, then maybe they put trees on stage at the top of the show.
Yeah.
But we've got to quite a kind of dispensable culture of building and throwing away sets, and that is not sustainable. And that if we believe that arts have the way we make art is important, along with the content of the art. The way in which we're not contributing to the climate crisis by making theatre is very important. And so reusing those elements is obvious. And increasingly, theatres and production managers and designers and teams are clubbing together to create stores and networks so that all this stuff can be reused and recycled.
Fantastic. And it also adds a sort of, for theatre nerds, it's quite a fun little Easter egg to know that that's from that production, or that's... You see it in movies and TV shows a lot.
But it shows you there's no such thing as a new idea, doesn't it?
Sure, yes. On a side note, just because I saw it in my notes, when you were doing the masterclass a couple of weeks ago, you directed Barefoot. Is that what you normally do, or is that an instance just for us?
No, I've always directed Barefoot. I suppose it's the legacy of Lecoq,
where
we had to work barefoot the whole time. I have always liked it. I can't quite tell you why. I feel it's grounding for me.
I know Tim Minchin always performs barefoot because in his mind, I'm just at home, and I'm barefoot at home, so I'm not in the Albert Hall or wherever. I'm just at home doing the songs, and it helps literally ground him.
Yeah, I would say something similar. It makes you feel more relaxed and like it's the beginning of work.
Yeah. Looking ahead to an upcoming production that you have, in presumably this same building that we're recording in, The Importance of Being Earnest. First of all, what motivated you to explore this text, and how are you reimagining it, reinterpreting it?
Well, I've always liked The Importance of Being Earnest. My father was in a student production of it when he was at university. Lovely. And so it's very personal. It's this personal, which was that when I was being born, my mum was in labour, and my dad was apparently making a nuisance of himself in the hospital. And so my mum said to him, go on, why don't you go out and buy this baby that's arriving a toy? So go to Hamleys or something. And so he got on the bus and went and got a toy teddy bear, which was really, I think, in a way of my mum getting him out of her hair for a bit while she was having contractions.
Yeah.
And the baby was called Algy. The baby was called Max, and the teddy bear was called Algy. And then when my sister was born a year and a half later, she has a teddy bear called Bunbury. So I always had a teddy bear called Algy. And then at school, I always loved the plays, because I think they were a way of talking about not conforming without having to be terribly explicit about what it was, which I think is one of the things that's happening in the play, which is Wilde, who is a socialist, and he's an Irish man living in London, and not a heterosexual man, whatever the right word is for his sexuality, a gay man, a queer man, a bisexual man, who wasn't an acceptable identity in 1900, was writing this massively popular comedy in the West End, and how could he be as subversive and open as possible without getting caught? And that's a really fine line he was pushing at the time, and you know, he pushed that line in the weeks when The Importance of Being Earnest, he pushed that line too far, and around the opening and indeed the closure of that show were the events that led to his trial and arrest. So I suppose I've always loved the play because on the one hand it's incredibly well-made comedy, and it's one of the funniest pieces of writing in the English language, and I like a good joke, and I like wit, and it just makes me smile and giggle. But I also think that there is a queer politics at work in that text that is often overlooked, and that weirdly The Importance of Being Earnest has been owned by quite a traditional part of British theatre. It's become absolutely part of the furniture. And there is something to me a bit surprising that Oscar Wilde, the radical queer author, has become quite so institutionalised in British culture. And I hope that this production will both celebrate the joy and the humour and the skill of his writing, but also point out the way in which he was pushing at the edges of Victorian traditional society, both by satirising it and by kind of confronting it, I think. Yeah. And putting his own identity in, almost hiding in plain sight, if you like.
Yeah. When you've done Shakespeare, you've always made an edit of the script. Have you edited Wilde?
Very lightly. So, amazingly, Wilde said he wrote it all in an afternoon. But actually, that's a lie. The play went through about 26 different drafts.
It's a long afternoon.
And if you look at, over months. And if you look at all those manuscripts, he's micro-revising and editing and making it better and better and better. And Wilde was a very good editor of his own work. So I went through quite a few of those editions, older editions, and there isn't much that's worth saving from the old versions.
Okay.
The one thing we're going to do is the first production, it was in three acts. Wilde originally wrote the play in four acts, but then his first director wanted to put a curtain raiser, which was an American one-act, half-hour comedy, at the head of the evening. And in those days, it was quite normal to have curtain raisers at the theatre. I suppose people think this is really weird now, but if you think about what a short film might be before a feature, it's a kind of similar thing.
So in the world of stand-up comedy, it might be an opening act. Is that
it could be an opening act, but it would have been the same actors doing it. So when the importance of Being Earnest opened, it was preceded by a half-hour American boulevard comedy, and then they got The Importance of Being Earnest.
Okay.
And in order to do that, Wilde cut some material from this play and moved it into three acts.
Mm.
And although lots of the material he cut was quite good cutting, because Wilde is clever person, he doesn't need another editor to help him.
Yeah.
What it did mean is that the shape of the evening is quite tricky, and it means that it has two intervals, and people don't really want two intervals for a show that's an hour and 45 minutes long.
Sure.
And so we are putting the interval back in the middle of Act Two, which is where he originally put it. So with a little bit of editing in that way.
Sure.
And I'm sure a couple of lines might have to change a tiny bit for various reasons, but basically we're doing the play as written by Wilde.
How excellent. How involved are you in the casting of a show?
Oh, fully. I think a lot of a show is made once you've cast it. That's a huge amount of... By the time you've got your team, that's 80% of the DNA of the show there, I think.
Sure.
So, yes, crucial. It's absolutely crucial.
And it's worthy of note, even as trivia, of David Tennant being the lead of Macbeth, and then Shuti Gatwa being the lead of Importance of Being Earnest.
Yes, to the very best of my knowledge, that's a complete accident. But they are both exceptional actors, and I'm very lucky to get to work with both of them.
Sure. What about Shuti? Did you most see or most excited about him embodying this character?
Shuti, most people know from telly recently, and of course from Doctor Who, but also Sex Education. But equally, I knew him as an actor back when he was doing stage. He was brilliant in some knee-high shows and at the Globe, and I think he's unbelievably charismatic and charming and funny, and I think has that Wildean elegance and playfulness that I think will make him a really wonderful Algy.
Staying with our location, what memories do you have of the National Theatre, and what does this building mean to you?
It means so much. I mean, I saw lots and do see lots of shows here, so it means really hundreds of shows I've seen, that most of which have been wonderful and all of which have been interesting and made by people with lots of craft and energy. And I think it's absolutely vital that we have a National Theatre, because it means that at the heart of this great city, we can make work in ways that wouldn't necessarily be commercially viable in the West End.
Mm.
So it means we can make the ticket prices lower, and therefore more people can come and see the work. And it means we can tell stories that might not instantly be thought to have a commercial audience, or plays that don't have a commercial audience, and actually often turn out to be wildly popular and have that commercial audience that no one believed they could.
Yeah.
But that it means that there's a real heart of artistic quality in the centre of London theatre, which is absolutely vital for our industry.
I couldn't agree more. So I was going to ask you how regularly you go and see shows that you aren't involved in, just to be aware of what's being put out. Presumably very often. And do you see across the spectrum, i.e. fringe, or stick mainly to sort of larger playing houses?
No, I try and see across the spectrum. The truth is that I have 2-year-old triplets at home.
Sure.
And so since becoming a father, my nights out at the theatre have slightly reduced, and I see less than I did 2 years ago. But, you know, that situation at home is getting a little bit calmer,
mm-hmm.
so I'm being able to go back out and see a few more things. No, I try and see across the spectrum of shows. I actually think there's a huge energy in younger theatre makers at the moment. I think the generation of my age, my peers, I'm 41, I think when we were younger, and of course this is a generalisation and there were exceptions, but I think a lot of people, when they were starting out 20 years ago, were trying to emulate the sort of work that Nick Heitner was making at the National Theatre. So even in the smaller studio and fringe theatres of London, there were quite a lot of shows that looked like less resourced National Theatre shows.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was a bit sad. And I think there is a sense amongst people 10, 20 years younger than me that the changes in the world that are going on mean we need to change the style and form and ways of making theatre, and that there is an increased radicalness in people younger than me, which I am really thrilled about. I don't mean it's easier. I think, if anything, it's got harder. I mean, it was harder when I was 20, and I think it's got harder again.
Sure.
But that there is an energy to kick against the system and reinvent the way in which theatre is being made that I think is not only refreshing but really essential. But I think probably was around less when I was younger.
What's something you see that young theatre makers, young directors, are new to the form, what are some rookie errors, pitfalls that you see some fall into that, as a guiding mentor, you would advise against?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's a horrible question. I fall into all sorts of pitfalls and rookie errors myself on a daily basis. So I feel absolutely unqualified to talk about rookie errors. I guess, actually, what I'd want to say on that subject is people are nervous about hiring younger directors. But then if you think about how many boring pieces of work are made by older directors as well, you know, that's also a problem too, and we don't discuss that so much. And so I think that I'd rather see something that had an error made by someone trying something new than an error of boringness by someone not trying something new.
An error of ambition rather than
an error of
creative neglect.
Rather than error of complacency and knowing how we do this.
Yeah.
John Cage said, "I don't know why people are scared of the new ideas, I'm scared of the old ones." And although I'm not always on that side, I think if I had to pick one side, I'd want to be on that side.
I would agree with that.
I also think, like, the situation we find ourselves in the world at the moment is a situation of extremeness.
Yeah.
If you think about what, even just like a really basic level of what, how much water London is going to be under at the end of the century.
Yeah.
And what that means in London, what that also means in the rest of the world, and who is going to be moving around the world in response to that, and what that means for London and the UK, and then also what that means in terms of the wealth disparity that's growing in our country. And that is actually a situation of extreme crisis, and that it seems to me that one of the things theatre can do at the moment is to try and meet that intensity of crisis with sort of an intensity of art to respond to it. And that might mean that some of the old forms aren't quite fit for fight in this battle, and that we do have to invent new and imaginative and daring and radical ways of looking at this crisis that we're in and acknowledging it as a crisis, rather than theatre as a form of kind of political pacifying and nostalgia, which it can so often be.
Totally. And it ties back into Macbeth in that you've spoken about how your starting point was a quote about extremists.
Maybe. I guess, really, I think my starting point, I mean, there was a different starting point for Macbeth. There was a more personal starting point for Macbeth.
Sure.
Which was that when my triplets were born, they had to spend 2 months in intensive care, which luckily was quite... they were quite stable through all of that, and multiples are often born early, and it was all quite safe. But that I had a recurring nightmare whilst staying over in the hospital that the incubator that the babies were in flames. And it happened night after night, and I woke up absolutely sweaty and ran in at 4 a.m, and there they were. And the machines were beeping, and they were all absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But that the sense of danger and of the future being lost, of the future being blocked up, and the future going up in flames was a sort of image for me at the heart of that production. I think for a while we thought we might burn a cot at the middle of the play, but then we didn't, and we ended up with something much more minimal.
Yeah.
But I think that sense of extreme horror and the sense of the Macbeths not having a future and what that means and leads to was my emotional way into the play.
It does seem that you put a lot of yourself into a play, that that you find a personal connection with the subject matter in order to do it. Is that right?
I think so. I think I direct better when it resonates with me.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, if I was being really... the sort of thing I could imagine Katie Mitchell wanting to say is that you should probably analyse the elements of the play which resonate with you and the elements of the play which don't, and then work towards how you're going to explore the elements of the play that don't.
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe in the second half of that statement. I'd have to really think about it. I think increasingly, in some ways, I feel okay conscripting older classic texts for a personal or political meaning. If it can, if the play can do that work now, then that's brilliant. I mean, is Macbeth really a play about PTSD and child loss? Well, maybe. It's also a play about kings and feudalism and succession, and I think an Elizabethan or Jacobean audience would have been very interested in all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Can you make Macbeth work as a play about PTSD and child loss? Well, I hope the answer is yes. So I think that's, in a way, that's the interesting question now.
It completely is.
And then the old text is still there for someone to do something else about.
Exactly, and I couldn't agree more on this point, because so often when you have a sort of imaginative or radical view of a classic text, there is inevitably the talking point of, but this isn't what was written down 450 years ago. It still exists. You can absolutely do a word-for-word, not shot-for-shot, but word like stage direction for stage direction production. But a creative reimagining does not destroy, it's not burning the Library of Alexandria.
No, and also, what is an authentic production now?
Yeah.
I mean, what do they really mean by authentic? Do they mean they want prepubescent boys playing all the women? Do they mean they want an all-white cast? Yeah. Do they mean they want to do it without any electric light? Do they mean they want to do it with people in the groundlings taking a shit in the corner of the globe? I mean, I think that's probably what originally happened. I caveat all-white cast, because actually there's some really interesting research that suggests some of Shakespeare's plays might not have had an all-white cast. But that's a whole other.
Okay.
That's a whole other subject.
That'll be part two of the podcast.
Not leading roles, though.
Sure.
That's a separate question. But no one really wants a so-called authentic production. They want bits of what they were used to when they were growing up, I think, which was not authentic at all. It was just made within the culture that they were growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, I
not in 1620.
Exactly. It's the essence of it wasn't like it was in my day.
Exactly.
They don't make them like they used to.
Yeah.
Which is the antithesis of creativity. Final two questions. One is, part A and B is, what is the best advice you've ever received, and what's the worst advice you've ever received?
So I went to see, there's a wonderful, now quite old Norwegian actor and director called Else Marie Lauchvig, who made very experimental theatre, and I went to see her, wonderful experimental theatre, and I went to see her to ask her advice about how to be a theatre director.
Yeah.
And I thought she was going to say something incredibly political about feminism or about psychophysical theatre and, something really deep and meaningful. And she gave me two pieces of advice, which I have stuck to this day, which is make sure that the actresses like their costume, and if something goes wrong, smile and giggle. And I have to say that both of those pieces of advice have served me really well.
Completely, completely. Finally, then, a question I ask everyone on the show. Why do we need stories?
Ah, yes, that's a huge question, isn't it? What's the best entry into that? I don't know, there's so many answers to that. It's a very important question. I suppose a story is kind of how we construct the world, isn't it? So that we all get so much information the whole time, we need a tool to put it together. So just as when I see your glasses, mm-hmm. my brain receives 5 million bits of information about your glasses, that there's dark brown and light brown things, there's a bit of gold there, but that actually my brain very quickly doesn't look at all that stuff, and it just goes, glasses, and I know you've got glasses on. And so, in a way, it goes from a huge amount of detail, with which there's no real need for me to engage with, to a simple fact, which is that you've got glasses. So, in a way, our very basis of perception groups a huge amount of input together to make it something.
Yeah.
And the story does the same thing on a larger scale. So just as there's so much information about the world going on, but we can't really engage in every data point about anxiety changing for children on phones, the weather changing, what I've had for lunch. All the stuff is so much and so overwhelming that we have to kind of group that together into some kind of story or some kind of narrative in order to be able to understand it. Because if we don't understand it, it's just like so much going on that we don't have any compass or rudder through it. So if stories are a way of understanding and navigating through the world, then that also means that they're a way of changing the world too. Because if we tell stories in a different way about the world, that means in a very real way, the world does actually start to shift. if we understand things slightly differently, if we can see things from another person's perspective that isn't ours, that means not only have we increased our hearts and our capacity for imagination, we have actually almost in a real way changed the world a little bit, so that actually story engineering is kind of a way of imaginatively being able to engineer the world in which we live, I think. And that's very, very important, because the stories we tell ourselves are our way of understanding the world.
Fantastic.
Lots of other ways of talking about why stories matter, but
I mean, feel free to go on the other ones. Although that is a very excellent answer.
Okay, all right.
We'll land the plane there.
Very good.
Max, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Pleasure. It's very nice to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.